Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Yeah, thanks, Ollie. Thanks a lot. Another lovely day in Salford and Greater Manchester. Lovely Tuesday it's been. It's lovely. Very lovely. And I've had a good day. I hope you're well. It's the 17th of September 2019. Your Richie Allen Show live on Fab Radio 2 here in the great, 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 greater Manchester. Triggerwarning.tv, my website richieallen.co.uk, and multiple other platforms as well. I have two very, very interesting guests lined up for you today. I know you'll be excited to meet them. So let's just get on with it, shall we?
Richie Allen.
It's the Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, this hour, I'm going to be joined live from California by none other than Zach Voorhees. Zach was a senior software engineer at Google, where he spent 8.5 years. The last 3 years of his employment, he spent, in fact, at YouTube. He noticed after 2016 that the company took a very different direction. That's after the election of Donald Trump. And he believed that the company then began engaging in very nefarious behavior. Shadow banning and banning and deleting and promoting one side at the expense of another. So Zach Voorhees joins the program this hour. And I want to give a big shout out to a former guest on the program. She will be back again. I'm speaking of Diane Emerson, really top lady, was on the program talking even about pedophilia and Epstein and all that on the program a couple of months ago. It was Diane that put me on to Zach Voorhees. She did all the groundwork. So thanks, Diane. Zach Voorhees joins the program. Voorhees, he was on with Lee Camp on RT about a week ago. He'll join me this hour live from California. And in the second hour of the program, Garrodo Colmón will be on. Garrodo is a terrific Irish journalist and a geopolitical analyst based in Paris. And among other things, he'll be talking today about India, Pakistan and Kashmir, which has been reported in a very one-sided way in Western media, of course. We'll talk about other things besides with Garrodo as well. How you doing? Are you well? Are you hale and hearty? Are you in good form? This will be a rather short monologue. I spent most of the afternoon, like the boring, monotonous, baldy gammon that I am, watching the live feed from the Supreme Court. I know. I'm grey. I've gone grey. Watching it has turned me grey inside and out. What are you talking about, Alan? What are you talking about? Well, the Supreme Court is hearing arguments for and against Boris Johnson's suspension or proroguing of Parliament. What was that? That was half my audience falling asleep on their feet. I know when I'm losing my audience. I'm an experienced broadcaster and producer, don't you know? I'll say it again. Brexit. That's the other half gone. So I'm here by myself now. I know people are pissed off at this. I know they are. That's why I try to be a bit irreverent in my analysis of it. It's why I try to be a bit comical in my analysis of it. And I only make myself laugh. I know that. But yeah, the Supreme Court has been hearing two appeals. This will go on today and tomorrow. About to determine whether or not Johnson acted lawfully when he suspended Parliament. He went to the Queen, of course. It's a constitutional monarchy. Your Madge, what? Can I suspend Parliament? Okay. And that's how it happens, basically. And he scheduled a Queen's speech so that in October he could, through, of course, the Queen's speech, lay out his plans for his government, because he's only been the Prime Minister a wet day or two or three. So they're at the Supreme Court now. Gina Miller's lawyer, barrister, guy called Panic. That's his name. That's a great name for a solicitor or a barrister, isn't it? Panic. Yeah, it's mad, I tells you. 11 Supreme Court justices are listening in for 3 days, led by Lady Hale. Lady Hale. Nothing to Alfie Hale in Waterford whatsoever. Nothing to Alfie Hale. Lord Keane QC, Advocate General for Scotland, spoke for the UK government. And as I said earlier, as the court heard from Lord Panic, QC for Gina Miller, who was challenging the suspension. Because you have to worry these days about people having no sense of humour whatsoever. Even somebody like me, I do find myself self-censoring. And I have railed against self-censorship. And I have sworn that I will never self-censor. And I have said to myself, say what you want, Richie, because people will know that you're joking. And then I've wanted to do little skits about Gina Miller, you know, little comic inserts. And I thought, a lot of people won't think I'm joking. And I've got black listeners, I've got Asian listeners, and I thought, they just won't realise I'm joking, they'll think I'm serious. So I've 86'd my Gina Miller insert. I was going to do a bit about Gina Miller, a little bit of a take on Little Britain, about her not even being white, and stuff like that, right, just to get a few giggles. And then I thought, don't do it, because people will think you're serious. Gina Miller, yeah. So the five-week suspension of Parliament began a week ago. Members of Parliament are not scheduled to return until October the 14th, and the opposition parties have been demanding that Parliament is indeed recalled. Recall it! Recall it! So that we can stop Brexit. Yeah. And Jo Swinson, the leader of the Liberal Democrats, Scottish woman, 38 years old, or I think, or 39. She gave the keynote address, of course, the leader's address, at the Lib Dems conference in Bournemouth today. And there is nothing so unfunny as a politician. Dreadful woman. You think they'd get... I don't know if any coach, if any man or woman, can improve somebody when it comes to public speaking. You're either very... as far as I'm concerned, anyway, you're either able to address large crowds or you're not. I don't think there's any in between. Swinson's address was painstakingly, monotonously boring. I was like the guy in Airplane when he was telling his story to people and they were killing themselves, watching it, committing suicide on the plane. I couldn't. I had to hear it for all of the virtue signalling bits in it about diversity and inclusion and tolerance and all the rest of it, just to drive me mad. But at the same time, I was pretty much on the verge of slitting the old wrists while watching it, Joe Swinson. Thanks to Sean Hinchcliffe for sending me an interesting piece from the Metro, which I missed in the week. That's a listener to the programme has tweeted me. And it's a bit in the Metro. The Metro's the same all over Europe. You get it on your trams, you get it on your trains, you get it on your buses. It's a free newspaper that is paid for by advertisements. And yesterday, I think, Sean, was it, or the day before, it might have been yesterday, James Hockaday, it was Sunday's paper actually, James Hockaday featured or wrote a piece about teachers including Brexit commentary in assemblies and classrooms at one school. That's St. Joseph's Catholic High School. And sixth form students there have been telling tales on their teachers, saying that the teachers have been telling them to back a second EU referendum and it would be in their interest. But how can they? I suppose they can vocally ask for it, but if they're in sixth form, is they're not likely to be able to vote in it or to be eligible to vote in it, are they? What age are you when you're in sixth form? 16, right? 17, maybe? At a stretch, I don't know. And the students say a senior teacher mocked Donald Trump and Boris Johnson in an assembly, telling students, you're not going to remember these two. Some students worry staff could mould the minds of younger pupils who are still forming their own political beliefs. Well, look, if they say religion and politics is no place in the pub, let alone in the classroom. If you're going to advocate for free speech, if you're going to agitate for free speech for one and all, maybe the teachers are entitled to share their opinions on Brexit with their students, however impressionable those students might be. I don't know. I obviously would take the opposing point of view. I suppose I would say that if I was teaching children, the thing to do with children is always tell them the truth, never lie to them, ever, on anything. There are things you shouldn't answer to students. There are things you shouldn't tell them. There are things you should say to students. Well, go and speak to your parents about those things. I'm just your teacher. I'm here to teach you how to read and write and to share some milestones of history with you and discuss them and all of that and read a bit of Shakespeare and a bit of Tennyson, don't you know, and a bit of Wordsworth. There are other things you should ask your parents about. If you're asking me about Brexit, this is what I think. But I think it's probably incumbent on teachers to always tell their students there is another side of the argument. I wouldn't mind that. Listen, I think we should stay in the European Union, but there is another side of the argument. You go and read both sides of it for yourself and make your own mind up. But I'm your teacher. I voted to remain, is what I would say in the place of the teachers at St. Joseph's College. Of course, I didn't vote for remain. Of course not. Of course not. 14 minutes past the hour. Tweet the programme at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. We're going to go to California real soon because I want to spend some time with Zach Voorhees, the former Google employee who has blown the whistle on the practices of Google stroke YouTube. We really want to hear this, don't we? I think we do. So we'll get him on. Hi to Faisal. Hi to Steve. How you doing, Steve? Nice to know you're listening today. Hi to Charlotte. How you doing, Charlotte? Full of a cold, says Charlotte. A stinking cold. Hi to William. Hi to Liz Jones. You're a masochist, says Liz. I am, Liz. I am. I do get something out of it, I think. That's the scene, Jason. That's the scene. I'm tweeting it. I'm retweeting it. I'm retweeting it. That's the scene from Airplane when Ted Stryker is telling the story of how he lost Elaine. Is it Elaine? Who's giving oral sex to a blow-up autopilot in the cockpit. Is that the one? That's the one. Hi to Paul Birchall. How you doing, Paul? To Les Hewitt, how you doing, Les? And to Natalie Stacey. It's a bit of a stretch, Natalie, but thanks for claiming or proclaiming this to be the best radio show ever. Might be a little bit of a stretch, Natalie Stacey. Right, I'm not going to really inflict much of a monologue on you today. It's all Brexit and Supreme Court. There are some interesting things going on. That Google, that European Union story that you heard on the news with Ollie Barrett, where the European Union have ordered Apple to give €13 billion in tax back to Ireland. It's not going to happen. Don't get your hopes up. I wonder, would Leo Varadkar, the Merry Indian, I wonder, will he decide to disperse that equally amongst our citizens back home for a party, for the biggest party the world has ever seen? Maybe. Well, now we've gotten the money back from Apple now. We've gotten the money back from Apple to €13 billion. Tell you what we're going to do now. We're going to have the biggest fucking party that the world has ever seen. From Stephen's Green to Glenamanna from Drogheda to Ballybeggan Waterford. The biggest piss up the world has ever seen. We're going to drown in Guinness and in what are they drinking? What are the kids drinking? Jaeger bombs, is it? I think it might be Jaeger bombs. Let's get out of this monologue because it's going nowhere. Let's go to California on Europe's most listened to independent radio show. It is the Richie Allen Show, live on Fab Radio 2, triggerwarning.tv, and my website, richieallen.co.uk. Zach Voorhees, former employee of Google and YouTube, is limbering up in the wings and joins us after a bit of John Farnham, a bit of old Aussie rock and roll. Music from John Farnham on the Richie Allen Show. The time is 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the programme. This is really important, this, so let's just get straight into it. My first guest today spent 8 years working at Google. He was a software engineer there, 8.5 years in fact, and the last 3 years he actually spent at YouTube itself. Back in 2016, he began to notice the company taking a bit of a different direction, and this was after the election of US President Donald Trump. They began, in his words, to violate their own mission statement. He saw that Google had begun pushing its own corporatist worldview and suppressing voices that dissented, that went against the narrative. And again, he saw this specifically happened after Donald Trump took office. Let's welcome to the program, live from California, the whistleblower Zach Voorhees. Zach, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing really good. Thanks for inviting me on your show. It's good to be on.
Thanks, Zach. I've just given a very brief explanation of your time at Google. We've got to the top of the hour if we need it, so we've got plenty of time for a chat. Tell us more about working there as a software engineer, what you did, and how you ended up at YouTube around about the time that Donald Trump became president.
Yeah, so I started off working at Google in their main campus down in Mountain View. I've worked for the company for a total of 8.5 years, and that was broken up into two sections. So the first section was 5.5 years working on the main campus, working on the Google Earth project, and I took the Google Earth project and put it into the Audi navigation system. I then left the company to start my own company, and then I came back in 2016 and worked for their YouTube division, which Google wholly owns. And when I came back, some things had changed. Like, it's the company seemed to be a little bit more progressive. You know, there were now like tampons in the men's bathroom, but I didn't really think
in the men's bathroom.
In the men's bathroom.
Wow. I shouldn't laugh at that, but the world has become a strange place, Zach. All right. So,
yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So I was like, well, this is a little bit, you know, extreme, but you know, they're entitled to have their own sort of moral standards, right?
Okay.
So I didn't really think too much of it. The company seemed pretty similar to what it was when I left. However, that all changed in when Donald Trump got elected president. The company decided that they were going to do a complete 180.
Now, how did you notice this? This is really interesting. So the president was elected in November of 2016, wasn't he? And was sworn in January of 2017. We're coming up on an election, of course, next year. How did you notice that manifesting itself exactly?
Yeah, so first off, I didn't think that Trump had any chance of winning. I thought the entire system was completely rigged beyond comprehension. So I didn't even pay attention to the election as it was happening on the day, and wasn't until I got unburied from my work that I noticed that people were getting quite upset. And then when I looked to see the election results as they were happening state by state by state, I realized that Donald Trump surprisingly was in the lead. And let me tell you, the entire mood of the office was completely like somber. People were upset. People were like, wow, it's not going good for us. And
was there any Trump supporters there? Because it's obviously a vast company, and even the wing where you worked, I would have imagined he would have had some support. No
one was really open about it. Everyone was kind of open with their support for Clinton. There was this feeling in Silicon Valley that Trump was the worst possible thing that was ever going to come down. I saw people on Facebook that didn't work for Google and also that did work for Google, you know, imploring people that this is the last stand, that they've got to elect Hillary Clinton, or a really dangerous fascist movement going to like sweep in. So this was sort of the mood throughout San Francisco and the Bay Area, and it certainly extended into the mood at the YouTube offices.
And you were obviously somebody who voted for Donald Trump. You preferred...
Oh, I didn't vote.
No. Okay, fair enough.
I didn't vote at all. Yeah, I was like, yeah, this is all corrupt. It's all fake. Like,
so you liked him. You were so convinced that Clinton was going to win, you just didn't go out. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I didn't want to vote for Clinton, and I didn't think that Trump actually had a chance. And, you know, California is so heavily skewed that my vote wasn't going to matter anyway. So yeah. I didn't even bother. Like, we're not a swing state in any, you know, anywhere close to being a swing state.
Yeah,
so
fair enough.
I didn't bother.
I spend a lot of time watching and observing U.S. politics, even from here in the U.K. So I understand what you say when you talk about California and the electoral college system. But Trump wins anyway, unexpectedly. I'd be the first to say that. I would be somebody who would revile the Clintons. I'll be the first to say that. And I thought that she was a shoo-in too, but she didn't win. Trump won. And you're there at YouTube. What happens after Trump wins? Because you reckon the company took a noticeably different direction after he was sworn in, or after it was announced that he had won the presidency. What happened then?
Well, Google had an all-hands meeting with their executive class. And they have about like a meeting once a week called TGIF, which stands for Thank Goodness It's Friday. Yeah. Surprisingly, this is actually held on Thursday now because we're international. So they had one of these TGIFs with the executives on board, and they were talking about what Trump means for the company. And let me tell you, it was sort of a circus. Like, one of the executives broke down into tears on stage.
You saw one of the executives even breaking down in tears over because of the Trump success.
Yes, that's right. She broke down on stage in front of cameras. As she was talking about the Trump, because she was so distraught over it. The former CEO, Sergey Brin, who co-founded the company, said that he was deeply offended at the election result. The Kent Walker, who I think is VP of one of the head attorneys, was saying that he was talking about, you know, how there was an undercurrent of like racism and sexism that was contributing to this election of Trump. And it was bizarre. It was bizarre how they were talking about this. Oh, and the worst part was that the CEO of Sundar Pichai mentioned that they were going to use an arsenal of AI tools in order to combat fake news.
Okay.
And I'm sitting there going, wait, combat fake news, right? Like, there was so much fake news that was happening that was favoring Clinton that I was wondering exactly what their definition of fake news was.
which one were they talking about? I'd love to have been there. Did anybody put their hand up and say to the executives, hang on a second here, a guy's just won an election, it's not the end of the world, you know what I mean? What's going on here? A guy won an election, why all of this outpouring? He won it fair and square, let's get on with it. Did anybody say that?
No, not that I remember. I mean, there's not a lot of, it was mostly like in support. And I think that it was like, if you come out there and you say, hey guys, it's an election, deal with it, it wouldn't have been, you know, received well by the company. Okay. Just because of the strength of the group thought. It was more like this was a period of mourning for the executive class, strangely, and for the rest of the company, was brainwashed.
Isn't that incredible? So let me just sum up a bit there, Zach. We've got Zach Voorhees live on the line from California. Zach is a whistleblower. He's worked as a senior software engineer for Google, 8.5 years in total, and he spent his last 3 years there at a very interesting time at YouTube when the Trump campaign team successfully negotiated the 2016 presidential election. And Zach is talking about a noticeable change in attitude and feeling around the company after the Trump victory, and he's just been describing executives, very high up people in the company, meeting, expressing, publicly expressing dismay and sadness at Trump's success, and then talking about the need to combat fake news. And of course, this is hugely interesting. So, Zach, you think, and I've been reading a lot about you, I've been watching some of the other interviews you've done, you believe that they began maybe at that stage to think about how do we silence the conservative media, whether it's the mainstream conservative media or the independent conservative media, how do we minimalize their impact or their reach? Do you want to tell us about how that happened?
Yeah, so what they did was they started to implement, started to expand their blacklists. They started to delist certain news publishers and cancel their ad accounts. So the lifeblood of these news publishers is being able to generate ad revenue from their stories that they publish. And so what Google was doing was that they were starting to implement new code of conduct, brand safe law rules within the company, and then finding out which of these more like, I guess you could call them like far right publications, and starting to remove them from their ad networks. And what happened is that we started to see a rise of third-party, left-wing troll accounts like Sleeping Giants, and they started to sort of troll sites like Breitbart, which I would consider left of, or right of center, and was applying pressure on Google to drop, you know, Breitbart from the ad networks, right? Cutting them off at the revenue source and trying to dry them out. And this was part of a coordinated attempt to demonetize and censor people and individuals and publications that didn't go along with sort of the establishment narratives that were being pushed by the Washington Post and the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, you know. And so I just saw this coordinated effort to do this takedown across all these different platforms.
When did this happen, Zach? This we saw this land with a bang in early 2017, didn't we? Because everybody was suddenly demonetized. And I had a YouTube channel at the time with nearly 100,000 subscribers, and it was growing at the rate of 5,000 subscribers a month. It's not about me now, this at all, but I was right there, and amazingly, you were right there. You were at the company. Early 2017, everybody all of a sudden gets demonetized. I was demonetized, and I depended on the Google advertising revenue to support my program, which isn't paid for by anybody. It's an independent radio show. It's paid for by the listeners. And bang, in 2017, all of a sudden, we saw all these stories saying that Google, YouTube are very concerned, or they said, didn't they? They said that the advertisers were telling them, the advertisers, Google said, let me get this straight. Google claimed at the time that the advertisers were communicating to them that they were very concerned about where their ads were appearing. So all the ads went, but are you telling me that isn't true? That the advertisers didn't all of a sudden swarm all over Google and say, stop putting our ads on Breitbart or InfoWars or whatever? What actually happened? It came from Google.
It's hard to know exactly what happened. I'm sure that there were some advertisers that certainly didn't want to have their brand, their ads appear on certain types of websites, but rather than giving those advertisers a tool to prevent and control where their ads were being placed, they decided that they were just going to start blanket censoring entire websites, you know, from their ad network in order to fix the problem.
How did they do that? That wasn't, because you talk about artificial intelligence algorithms, which is massively important for my listeners to understand what that is. Was that a manual process at that time, Zach, or did they have teams of people? It was manual. Go ahead.
Yeah, it was manual. They were dropping people from the ad networks manually based on, you know, some sort of group coming forward and complaining about, you know, something that this author had said,
right,
you know, or you know, something that didn't align with the narrative. And so, but the machine learning stuff is actually a really interesting topic, because this was something that was in process in the pipeline for a very long time. And then once Trump won, it sort of went from, you know, 20 kilometers an hour to like 80 kilometers an hour. Just they sped it up and they just started unleashing it into the different products within the company. And I actually found out about this project because I was looking at what the definition of fake news was within the company. And as I started looking at these PowerPoint presentations, what I've noticed is that they were referring to this project called Machine Learning Fairness. And so I started to dig in. I was like, well, what the heck is this machine learning fairness is? Oh, it's this project out of Stanford that is going to apply bias across the entire internet because they think that objective reality is bias in itself and unfair. And this isn't just my interpretation. They actually came out and said this, in which they gave an example stating that if someone was to do a Google search for the word CEO, and if the results came back mostly male, and even if that reflected objective reality, it could be still considered algorithmically unfair.
Sexist.
And
wow.
And yeah, and that it would be considered algorithmically unfair and justify intervention via product intervention.
Oh, now, can you explain that in the most basic English you possibly can for me and for my listeners? I think I get this. It's scary stuff, this. Go ahead.
So if someone searches for CEO and it returns mostly male results, that's unfair, and Google should return a 50-50 between, you know, 50 female CEOs and 50 male CEOs.
Right. Wow.
And so they decided that they were going to elect themselves to be the arbitrators of exactly what was fair, what was not fair.
So what that means is then machine learning, eventually the machines will decide what's right and what isn't right. So somebody could go on to Google, which is basically is the internet, and look for information on vaccine safety. Now, I'm not anti-vaccine, Zach, or anything like it, but I do believe that some vaccines are harmful. We've seen evidence of it in Ireland. So in the future, a mom who's thinking about the HPV Gardasil vaccine and is hearing that some girls are getting ill after taking it, she might go on to Google and go looking for information, and the machines might kick in and say, no, everything is fine, don't worry about it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the Trojan horse here is that they're saying that it's for social justice, but in reality, it's going to be turned and used for corporate interests, because it's not fair, you know, in that scenario to return results that reflect, you know, the amount of parents that have damaged children because of vaccines, which, I mean, it's incredible that we have a vaccine fund in the United States that pays out damages. And in the last couple of decades, it's paid out $4 billion in damages. You know, if that's deemed unfair, then that information can be hidden from the user. And this is quite ironic, given that the mission statement of the company, Google, when it launched its IPO, was organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. Now, how can they make it universally accessible if they're acting as a censor?
This is amazing stuff. And they've come after you since you left, because tell us about taking documentation. And I don't want to say it like that, because I don't believe it's stealing at all. I believe it's
copying. No, it's not copying. Stealing means you deprive someone of something else.
Zach, it's in the public interest. And it's in the public interest. You didn't steal, you copied. Right. I'm correcting myself. You're absolutely right. So tell us about that, documentation and their response to you copying that.
Right. So once I started finding out that there was all these secret projects that Google was working on and not telling the public about, I realized that, you know, they were so atrocious that once these things started leaking out, and they would leak out, I realized that Google would wisen up and start shutting down access. So without determining whether I was going to leak or not, I decided to start archiving all of these documents offline so that I would have the opportunity downstream to be able to possibly, you know, disclose this to the public. That kind of happened in waves. I would go and I would do a bunch of research, collect links, and then, you know, after hours, I would, like, you know, download and archive these files. I actually made the decision that I was going to, you know, leak these things after I saw Google deleting words out of their translation dictionary in order to make a Trump tweet sound crazy. Okay. And this happened in May of 2017. Trump went to Saudi Arabia. He came back and he made this tweet, despite the negative constant press, kefefe. And then he tweeted out, does anybody know what the word kefefe means? Have fun. Well, people figured out what it meant. It translated into something along the lines of, we will stand up. So what Trump was saying was, despite the negative constant press, we will stand up. Well, the New York Times decided that this word actually didn't mean anything, that it actually was complete nonsense. And so it wrote an article saying as much. Google took that article by the New York Times, created a design document to delete the word covfefe out of their Arabic to translation dictionaries. The team that was assigned to delete this word called themselves the Derrida team. Why is that significant? Because there was a philosopher, a French philosopher by the name of Jacques Derrida, who advocated for the destruction of Western civilization through the manipulation of language.
Of information.
So how ironic is it that the team responsible for censoring this word were naming themselves after this philosopher? And so at that point, I was like, okay, I've got to disclose this to the American public. I've got to disclose this to law enforcement. This is seditious activity. And if I don't report this, then I myself in conspiring in order to cover up criminal activity and, you know, sedition. So at that point, I reached out through my media contacts and was able to get a hold of Project Veritas, who sent a handler down to San Francisco, and I became friends with them. And then eventually after they earned my trust, I delivered to them 950 pages of Google's internal documents describing this machine learning fairness, their censorship, and all this other, you know, related stuff about how they were going to sculpt the information landscape in order to, you know, meddle with elections, to satisfy their political agenda. And then they held on to that until 2019, when they were able to do an undercover sting of Jen Janai, the AI trust and safety executive, who stated in an undercover video that only a company the size of Google could prevent the next Trump situation in 2020. So once Project Veritas had that video, they contacted me, asked me to make a comment and give them my analysis. I gave them my analysis. They asked me if I was willing to come to their offices in New York and record that on in front of a camera. At this time, I was actually about to resign. Like that day, I was writing my resignation letter, and they interrupted me when they, while I was writing it. And so I said, "Absolutely, I'll come to New York." And so I sent my resignation letter to Google. Rather than giving me the 2 weeks, they accepted it and made it effective immediately, and asked me to sign a non-disclosure agreement, which I ignored because there's no way I'm going to do that.
Was there a financial incentive to sign the NDA, Zach, or wasn't there? No.
No, they just expected that I would sign this NDA as like a continuing obligation as a former employee, and I just ignored it because why am I gonna? Yeah, they're not even offering me money, right? Like they've put me through trauma. Like I believe that Google was the best company. I argued with my girlfriend in 2011. She was from the Soviet Union. She said that Google was going to be one of the worst entities ever. I said, "No, you're wrong. Google's different. You know, they're one of the good people." And she was completely right, and I was completely wrong. And it traumatized me because it flipped my entire outlook on, you know, the goodness of companies to do the right thing. And it turned out that the company that pretended to be the very best, like the exceptionally best company out there, turned out to be the absolute worst company out there. It's absolutely mind-blowing. So
do you know what it's like, what I've got to keep coming back to, this is really important. What you've seen there, and you and I might have a conversation another time on this program. We might argue about the merits of or the demerits of Donald Trump, because I believe it's much bigger than anybody, and I'm not convinced that Trump is genuine anyway. I would stand alongside any Trump supporter and talk about the evil of the Clinton dynasty and all of that all day long, but I'm no fan of Donald Trump, and I'm no fan of any politician on the left, on the right, in the centre. It doesn't matter to me, but we could talk about that another day because this is hugely important. I want to remind our listeners who might just be joining the program. You are with the Richie Allen Show. It's 14 minutes to the top of the hour. It is Tuesday, September 17th. Zach Voorhees is live on the line from California. 8.5 years at Google, software engineer, spent 3 years at the very end around the election and thereafter of Donald Trump, and noticed the company was taking a very different direction post the election of Donald Trump. Executives in the company went into veritable kind of meltdown because of the Trump success, and began to talk about fake news and the need to limit the reach of conservative commentators, websites, conservative YouTube channels, and I can echo that. I saw that myself. I suppose, Zach, this will make you giggle, I'd be considered far left or socialist, but that, again, that's a conversation for another day. Zach began to see where this was really going. This is really important, this. And what to sum this up, I suppose, Zach, you could say that over a period, it began Google to try and map out a future where it was the arbiter of reality, where it became basically the decision maker, God in effect, deciding what is right, what is wrong, what is fair and what isn't. And that's where this is ultimately going. And I think it's kind of, you might disagree with me now, and feel free to disagree, by the way, you know. We might be on the same page here, but we might see it a bit differently. I think it's leveled out in terms of, it isn't solely conservative commentators, websites and channels they're going after. They're going after anybody that is asking any sort of question, whether it's about health, whether it's about the Middle East, whether it's about war. I think it's kind of leveled out. What do you think in terms of the censorship?
I mean, it's pro-corporate, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's pro-corporate masquerading as left-wing censorship.
Yeah.
And what I see is, I see that there's these grievance groups that are used as Trojan horses in order to shut down free speech around the internet. And this is what's really, you know, dangerous about it, is because if you're opposing censorship, then what they're twisting it into is that you're victimizing trans people, you know, because the censorship is always in response to some right-wing thing that's happening, you know, across the internet. And whatever happens seems to be, you know, amplified and then spun. And then by the time it gets written down on paper, it's a complete mockery of what actually happened.
Yeah.
You know, something trivial gets amplified. And this is the problem reaction solution situation that they go in order to do their totalitarian tiptoe. You know, I mean, I remember that prior to 2016, you know, Google was unwilling to shut down accounts linked to ISIS terrorists in Syria because they said that would, you know, set a dangerous precedent. But now, and, you know, fast forward to 2017, you know, you use something, you know, you use the wrong pronoun, and it seems that that's being spun up and amplified and being used as a justification to, you know, ban somebody. I mean, they've banned people on Twitter because they've dead named people. They've used the name that someone used previously when they were, you know, a different gender, you know, and then the person used their legal name, and then that's now justification enough to, like, ban people off of Twitter. It's turned into a whole clown show. And the idea that there's some sort of defenders of the minority, the vanguard of these the grievance cultures is a complete joke. What they're trying to do is they're trying to control the information landscape in order to seize power. You know, words are not used as a free marketplace for ideas. It's a battleground where combat takes place.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what we started to see in 2017, radically. They pushed it as far as they could. And then, you know, the American people started to wake up and push back. And the crazy thing was that I saw this stuff going down, and as it was happening, I was trying to warn people that, you know, Google was not this neutral company anymore, that it was a highly biased political machine. And the influencers I was talking about were like, really, really, that's what's coming down the pipeline? And I was like, yes. I was like, yes. I was like, yes, this is what's happening. And if you don't take me seriously now, you will in the future, because time's on my side. And that's what we saw. We saw, you know, a whole bunch of of censorship being unleashed throughout time, and it just kept on getting more extreme.
Can I ask you this, Zach? Can I ask you this before? Sorry to interrupt you now. We've got another 10 or 12 minutes if we need it. Apologies for interrupting you, because we have to just remind our listeners who you are and why you're here. Zach is a whistleblower, and he's worked for Google. I mentioned this already. Worked at YouTube. He copied documents. He didn't steal them, to blow the whistle on where the Google, not only the Google censorship is going, but the machine learning programs that they have that are going to decide, machines, by the way, in the future, what is okay to see, what isn't okay to see, what is right and what is wrong. Zach Voorhees is here. I'm delighted you're on the program, Zach. I'm delighted that in the last few weeks you've been invited on programs to talk about this. People need to hear this. And I want to ask you about this. I've heard quite a bit over the years about a woman called Regina Duggan, who in 2012 went to work for Google as an executive. And Duggan came, she's not with Google anymore, I don't believe, but she came from DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. DARPA, of course, a very sinister Pentagon-connected organization. And I wonder what you think about that, about her coming to work for Google in 2012, because her time span at the company, I don't want to be laying all the blame at this one woman, but the time frame of her being at the company fits in with what you've been telling us. What do we know about Regina Duggan?
Yeah, I don't know much about this individual person, but I do know that Google was funded by public money through Incutel and DARPA. So DARPA is a defense organization working through as an extension of the U.S. military. Incutel is a venture funding capital arm of the military-industrial complex of America. They're the ones that pumped money into Google, and you know, early on. And so there's a lot of spooks as I started talking to like spies and intelligence officers. Through this story, it turns out that a lot of these people like that come in have really shady pasts. They come into the executive, you know, class, and they their names have changed. And it turns out that their history has been obscured. And I'll give you an example. There's this guy by the name of Chris Poole. He founded supposedly 4chan, the image board. And then he announced that he was going to work for Google. I try to reach out and say, hey, man, I'm really, you know, like, that's amazing that you made 4chan. You know, what was it like? He never responded. I started to search for his information within the company, and I couldn't find it. In fact, the guy was a ghost. He didn't exist. And there's a lot of these individuals that have these really shady pasts that work in these tech companies, not only Google, but Twitter and Facebook. And
tell me about Facebook, Zach. Tell me about Facebook. How relevant is Facebook to your story and to what's happening at Google? I intervene there because we're getting a lot of tweets on this, by the way, a lot, understandably. And William in Scotland has asked me to ask you about Facebook. Any chance all of this is all hand in hand, these companies?
Yeah, I mean, they're all colluding together. I mean, you can tell because when Alex Jones was banned off the internet, you know, off the social media platforms. It all happened within a minute of the banning. Like, it happened on YouTube, it happened on Facebook, you know, it happened on Twitter. And it was like within minutes of each other, it was like, bam, 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 he was removed. And that coordination wouldn't happen if these companies were all working independently for another. I mean, at least have the semblance to wait a day and then be banned from a different platform as a reaction to the other platforms. But no, because it's within these minutes, you know, it's clear that these tech giants are being controlled by the same shadowy group, you know, behind, you know, some sort of mask of anonymity. And exactly who is controlling them is a question that I'm trying to find answers to. Like, how is it that this group of insiders can ban the same person across all social media platforms? Like, I thought these were different companies.
Yeah, at the same time. I remember it happened to various commentators here in the United Kingdom at the same time as well. Some of these people, I wouldn't share their worldview, but I would defend to the death their right to say what it is they believe, even if I don't agree with them. And that's where I think we should be.
Like, let the bad ideas fail on their merits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know? Discourse, Zach. Argument. You know, but, yeah. but respectful argument. Yes, let everybody be heard. I mean, I'm a child of the late 70s and 80s. I remember watching television in the 80s and seeing all sorts of weird and wonderful people with sometimes outlandish points of view, but they were out there and they were listened to. And as you said, some of these ideas, we went, oh, Jesus, that guy's a lunatic. But that's the way it should happen. You shouldn't be banning people or forcing them underground. And you see this machine learning. We've got Zach Voorhees, live on the line from California, former Google YouTube employee, has blown the whistle on where this is all going. This is going to the hands of artificial intelligence to shape a world where everything that we see, everything we hear, even everything we think is going to be controlled by Google and by Facebook and by Twitter. That's where it's heading. It sounds very melodramatic, but it sounds to me that's where you think this is all going unless we stop it.
That's right. And I want to let you know that, you know, when Google found out that I was intent on leaking all of this to the public and that I was the whistleblower, they did intimidation tactics against me. They tried to call in a wellness check to my house.
A wellness check? A wellness check?
A wellness check. So that's when they, you know, if someone's concerned that someone's going to commit violence or commit suicide, then what they can do is they can call in a wellness check to the police. The police come and ask the person questions. And if anything seems out of the ordinary, then the police will take the person in under custody for like a week so that they can undergo psychological evaluation.
Can you be sure it was them, Zach? Can you be sure it was your former employer?
Oh, yeah. The police told me after the whole ordeal. Let me tell you, when they sent a wellness check, I did not answer the door and I did not act like I was home. And because I, as a citizen, have a right not to talk to the police. Well, the police didn't just go away, or what they did is that they escalated and they used this excuse that they saw a tin can next to the gate of my house and they thought to themselves, well, could this be a bomb? So they called in the bomb squad to my house in San Francisco.
No way.
And because it's a bomb possibility, they have to shut down the streets. They evacuated the Marsh Theater right next to my house. They shut down multiple blocks on Valencia Street, which is a hugely popular street in like San Francisco. The FBI got called in. They put men with like sniper rifles up on the rooftops of the opposing houses. And they brought in bomb robots so they could figure out whether the tin can next to the gate door was a bomb or not. Now, it wasn't a bomb. It was denatured alcohol that my roommate uses in order to spin fire at these festivals that she goes to in California. And so I'm sitting in my house wondering, like, why there's a helicopter flying so close to my ceiling going, no, there's no way these police officers have, you know, called in helicopters. You know, it's probably some murder across the street that coincidentally happened.
Yeah.
Well, no, it turns out they were waiting for me to try to come out. They're trying to contact me on text. And I'm like, look, I don't want to come out. You know, I'm talking to the police, like through this text messaging. Like, I don't want to come out. I'm just going to tell you, like, you know, that this is probably called in by Google and they're trying to, you know, retaliate against me for leaking their information to the Department of Justice. And eventually through a friend of mine, they negotiate for me to come out. I come out with my hands up. They have me at gunpoint. You know, they turn me around. They, you know, they lock my arms. They frisk through all my pockets. And then they bring me to a police officer who asks me a bunch of, a bunch of wellness questions. And at the end of it, you know, the questions were like, you know, do you intend to hurt yourself or others? Do you have any fantasies? Are you supposed to be on any medications that you haven't taken? You know, those sort of questions. And then they say, well, why would Google, you know, call in this wellness check? And at that point, that's when I knew it was Google because the police told me that it was. And I said, yeah, I know why they would do this. It's retaliation for leaking their information to the DOJ.
So it was
and
a slip
like,
of
do
the
you
tongue.
Have any, yeah. Do you have any evidence of this? And I said, yes, I do. I took a snapshot on the letter that I sent them. I gave it to the officer. He looked at it and he's like, wow, you're a whistleblower. I was like, yep, I'm a whistleblower. And then everything started to de-escalate once they found out that that Google had a cause to retaliate against me.
Well, that's good news. I mean, I don't have a very high opinion of law enforcement people these days. That's good news that they de-escalated. And do you still get contact from Google from your former employers these days, Zach, or have they just given up now because you released the documents that you photocopied?
They're still in contact with me. They may sue me. I'm not entirely sure what they're intending to do. They were kind of aggressive over the letter to try to intimidate me. They're doing it through a law firm. And now they're like, hey, where'd you send the laptop to? Where'd you send the documents to? And I was just like, send it over here. And they're like, could you please do a search and let us know all the documents that you still retain? And I said, look, I've released all the documents that I know that I've had to the DOJ and to the media. And if I do a thorough search and I find any additional documents, then I want to let you know that I'm going to also turn those into the media and law enforcement as well. And that was the last letter that I sent to them. So we'll see exactly what they're going to do. They wanted to look through my computer and all my backup, you know, information sources to try to ascertain and delete the evidence of their criminal activity. But at this point, most of the documents, well, all the documents that I know that I've had have been released. And so the damage has already been done. People know who I am now. So I'm anticipating that they're going to back off a little bit, because every single time they've tried to intimidate me and threaten me, it just ends up in a PR nightmare.
It's backfired on them, thank God. Look, in the last 90 seconds we have left, first of all, thanks for coming on. What you've done is in the public interest, not in the American public interest, in the public interest. It's of interest to every human being on planet Earth, because what they're trying to do, and I'm very much like you, Zach, I'm very interested in where this goes. You know, who's really behind it? Thanks for coming on to talk about it today. I hope you'll stay in touch with us. Obvious next question for me to you is, how are you doing now in terms of working? Are you back at work? Are you going to be working? I mean, you're a software engineer, or has what happened made it difficult for you? What do you say?
I'm blacklisted. You know, it's like there was a company that has a very prominent entrepreneur within the Bay Area. They reached out to me to have me work. As soon as they saw that I was a whistleblower, they're like, yeah, we can't touch you. Sorry. Like, my work prospects have been destroyed. I've got some savings that I've had because of Google, but I don't know if I'll ever be able to get a job again in Silicon Valley. But you know what? To let the American people know, and the rest of the world to know, Google's extensive election meddling that they've been doing, I think it's worth it. I think it's worth it, because now I can, you know, have a clear conscience.
No, I think you're great. We could have talked about Tulsi Gabbard. We know that they were caught red-handed, you know, taking money from her and then screwing her by not giving her that which they promised they would give her. I have no doubt they had a hand in the spurious accusations about Russian meddling. Absolutely spurious nonsense. Whatever I might think about Trump, I would never tell lies. Trump wasn't in any collusion whatsoever with the Russian government. It's complete nonsense. I think you've done a great thing, Zach. Thanks for coming on to the program today. Please stay in touch, and I'm sure there will be follow-ups, and you're welcome to come back on and speak to us anytime. Is there anywhere, are you online, Zach? Is there any place you'd like to direct people to go and find out more about what you've been doing?
Yeah, so if your audience wants to help keep me alive, then the best way is to get eyes on me, and the place that I'm at is on Twitter. They can search for me at Perpetual Maniac.
Yeah, I've got it here. I'm connected to you on Twitter. It's at Perpetual Maniac. If you look for Zach Voorhees, that's Vorhies, you'll be immediately directed there. Follow Zach on there. And on his Twitter, at Perpetual Maniac, on his homepage, his profile page on Twitter, is a link to Project Veritas. And you can see all the documentation that Zach photocopied and released. Thanks for your time today, Zach. I really appreciate it. I'm pulling for you, and I hope you'll come back again when you feel it's time to come back, when there's an update for us.
All right, Paul. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to talking to you again and coming back on.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for that. That was Zach Voorhees, live in California there. Speaking to your Richie Allen show, not Paul. I don't know who Paul is. But there you are. Thanks so much to Zach. And again, I want to give a big shout out to Diane Emerson, who's a journalist who's got a really important YouTube channel as well. And Diane connected me with Zach. She's been in conversation with him, and she connected him to this program and overnight got him to come on. So thanks to Diane. Credit where credit is due there. It is 6 minutes past the hour. I'll take some music. When we come back, we'll have a look through the Twitter comments. Don't forget that Gerardo Colmon will be live on the programme from Paris, France, in a few minutes' time as well. In the meantime, here's music from The Fray. This is your Richie Allen Show, live from Salford. Step one. Music from The Fray on The Richie Allen Show. That's How to Save a Life. The time is exactly 10.5 minutes past the hour. Fascinating stuff, that, in the first hour from Zach Voorhees, former Google and YouTube employee. Fascinating stuff. And it doesn't get any less fascinating. You might be following, you might not be following events in India and Pakistan over Kashmir. You might be, you might not be. Brexit and many other issues. Obviously, Iran, Saudi Arabia, the allegations, Syria, a lot of other stuff going on at the moment. But Kashmir is very important, as much because of the way it's being reported in the Western media. And I want to talk a little bit about that and other issues with my next guest, who's not been on the programme for ages. And I genuinely have an enormous amount of time for him. He's a brilliant Irishman, a terrific journalist. And you can read him at his own website, gerardocolmon.org. Get on to the website if you haven't been on it before. Lots of interesting, very important, very pertinent articles on there, video and audio as well. You can often see him on RTV. He's been on Press TV and many, many other very well listened to and watched podcasts and video casts as well. Terrific to welcome back to the show from Paris, our old friend Gerardo Colmon. Dia Gwit, Gerard, how are you?
Tommy Gamar,
Diego, it's good
to have you on. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, no, it's great to have you on. I know you've been busy this week. I know you've been doing shows with Graham in Ireland. I've been just picked up Graham recently, actually, Graham Hart. I find that very interesting. I don't know why I didn't know about that. Yeah, it's great to see stuff going on back home. Tell us, we'll talk first about Kashmir and Pakistan. You're about the only credible journalist, I believe, that's writing about it. And you're particularly fascinated by the Western media coverage of it. Do you want to give? I'm putting you on the spot now a bit, and maybe it's me being lazy. Do you want to give us? Do you want to give us a bit of a cliff note revision of what the problem is in Kashmir, India, and Pakistan for our listeners?
Well, yeah, I suppose first of all, the media representation of what's going on there has been very one-sided. Because anybody who's seen any news stories of it will probably, have heard about the curfew, the crackdown, the brutal crackdown. The internet was cut there for a while. Military occupation, or even the Indian invasion of Kashmir. You know, it's very much biased in favor of Pakistan's view. So you had Imran Khan, the Pakistani prime minister, calling for UN intervention. That didn't really work, but it was very much internationalized. The recent crisis what happened basically is the Indian government abrogated an Article 370 of their constitution, which basically was an article that said that Kashmir and Jammu region would be sort of semi-independent until such time as it was reintegrated into the Indian Republic. So it was meant to be a temporary measure to facilitate Jammu and Kashmir region to facilitate their full incorporation into the Indian Republic. Obviously, it's a disputed territory, and half of the territory is Muslim. There's a lot of issues there. The division of India itself was obviously, the fault of the British. It was also partly the fault of, the Indians themselves. Nehru had an affair with Jawaharlal Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India. He had an affair with Mountbatten's wife. And I think we all know now that, you know, what kind of a creep Lord Mountbatten was.
Yeah.
And, you know, Nero, there are questions about Nero too. I won't get into that now. But in any case, it was a shambles. I mean, India shouldn't have been divided. I suppose, like Ireland, it got divided and, you know, on religious lines. And the Kashmir territory was disputed ever since. But, you know, from the Indian point of view on this is basically has basically been ignored in the press reports on what's happening there. Not only that, but you know the Muslim population are sort of there's a sort of an attempt to turn the Muslim population of Kashmir into victims in this. And that somehow, you know, they're being victimized by an evil, fascistic regime. You know, the Modi regime in India is part of the Hindutva movement, which is a nationalist movement, and which has its merits and demerits and its problems. But it's an attempt, I think, by Indians to actually finish the conquest of their country, because you know the majority of the population are Hindu. And they've never had, you know, in a way, what it is a failure of secularism. And we're seeing that right across, you know, the board in every country right now, just the failure of secularism. In other words, secularism is a myth. When you have a secular government, what you get is a secular liberal regime that favors minorities to the detriment of the majority.
Yeah,
you
know? It does. We see
and
that
it's,
here.
Essentially, we're seeing that everywhere, you know, and India's no different. So you have a deeply corrupt liberal establishment in India. The media there are just like the media here. You know, they're kind of they're anti-Indian in the same way that the British media are anti-British and Irish media are anti-Irish. And you know, the Modi government, are sort of they're the populace really of India. And they're attempting to basically, finish the sort of conquest of the country, really, and integrating Kashmir fully into India is part of that. Whether that's justified or not is another question, because, you know, it's a question of international law and you've got another sovereign state. But what my focus really was more on just actually explaining India's point of view, because that was just not in the media.
Totally absent from UK media. Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to lie and say that I've been on top of it. I haven't. I've been focused elsewhere. But I have seen Imran Khan on BBC programmes. I've seen him on Channel 4 Media. And I've not seen counterbalancing interviews with Indian officials. I haven't. You've answered my next question, which is, why is the media so biased? And you've talked about secularism, because maybe this is some sort of a greater plan, and that's why they're so focused on presenting this Pakistani narrative. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, with as far as I can see, there are three main problems coming for India, and they're very serious problems. Obviously, the Kashmir is one. The other one is the northeastern region and the state of Assam. And the state of Assam in the northeastern region, which is near Bangladesh, they have a huge mass immigration problem of Bangladeshi Muslims. And it's gotten out of control. So right now they have a national registration commission, which actually existed since 1951. It was always there. It was obviously they had big problems in India deciding who's who and who's going to go to which state after independence. So they needed to set up some kind of identification system. And that system has existed since the 1950s, but it's been reactivated and updated by the current regime, because they basically, again, they want to clean up a lot of the mess in India. And one of the problems in Assam is that the Hindu population there, they fear they're going to become a minority, because the Bangladeshis are coming across the border. They're occupying government land. They're getting benefits from the Indian government through corrupt officials in the region and so on. And Assamese, you know, citizens are becoming dispossessed. And so they fear that they're going to become a minority in their own state. And now that's a very serious issue in India because of the ethnic tensions they've had. I mean, you had ethnic cleansing in Kashmir in the 1990s. Again, the media never talks about it.
No, never.
You had thousands of Hindus had to flee Kashmir in the 1990s. And over 5,000 Hindus flee Kashmir region every year. So ethnic cleansing is actually still going on there. And for the Assamese, obviously, you know, these Bangladeshi settlers are taking land. And, you know, these are poor countries. They, you know, land is vital. Resources are scarce. They're dispossessing poor people. And so, you know, there's a fear that if the Muslim population in Assam gets any bigger, that the population, that the native population will become a minority, and that will ultimately end up in ethnic cleansing. And they fear that they are going to become refugees in their own country. So I'm interested in this, obviously, because this is a global problem. I mean, it's happening in every country now with mass immigration, and it's the same agenda in every country. Bangladesh is overpopulated. They have, you know, so people are emigrating en masse from Bangladesh into Myanmar, into India. But, you know, that's a big problem for India. And again, that is not being explained in the media. The origin of the problem, the scale of it. Obviously, India has been just accused of wanting to ethnically cleanse the Muslims, but nobody's talking about Muslim ethnic cleansing of Hindus. And so in this case, the bad guys are the Hindus, and that's basically the moral of the story. They're the bad guys. You know, when they get massacred, that's not even reported. And you see the same thing happening in Myanmar with the Rakhine Buddhists. When they get killed, the media don't even investigate. So they're sort of the designated bad guys in that story. And you find this in countries all over the world. You know, I guess in Europe, in Ireland, it'll be the ethnic Irish who will be the bad guys, or the ethnic English in England. You know, it seems to be usually the sort of indigenous, what you might call the indigenous population of whatever country. They're sort of the designated evildoers, and there's just no balance. There's no contextualization. So that's one problem facing India. It's a major crisis. You read articles in The Guardian going on about, you know, comparing the Indian government to Nazi Germany and concentration camps and, you know, all this kind of stuff. It could become a catastrophe, humanitarian catastrophe. But again, no attempt to, you know, look at it objectively. Another problem facing India is Punjab. And here it just gets kind of, this is the subject of my next article, because it's a deeply sinister story, what's happening there.
This borders.
Khalistan.
Yeah.
The Khalistan independence movement.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's quite big in England. I mean, there's a huge Sikh, you know, obviously Indian community, and I suppose Sikh in particular.
In here in Manchester.
In England. In Canada, I believe they're the fourth biggest ethnic minority, the Indian Sikhs. So Canada is the kind of home, it's the biggest, I think they have the biggest Sikh population outside of India. And basically there is an independence movement which has been going on for years. But, you know, that movement is very much being supported by politicians in Canada and in England. And if you pay attention to the way politics is starting to work in the West, the left liberals are relying more and more on votes of minorities, you know. So Corbyn and, you know, Trudeau and all these people, they pander to whatever, you know, ethnic minorities are in their country to get votes. And that's what, you know, the more the merrier for them. So this is kind of basically what you're seeing developing here is an independence movement very much supported by politicians in the UK and in Canada. And this actually led to a diplomatic spat, I believe it was last year, between India and Canada, because the foreign minister of Canada is a Sikh, and when he went to India, he met basically Khalistani separatists. So the Indians were freaking out over that. They refused. Modi refused to actually meet Trudeau over this. He sent a low-level official to greet him. So, you know, there's already a diplomatic tension with the West because of this. And again, if you read the nationalist media in Italy, you know, they're accusing the British of backing terrorism. And, you know, would that surprise us? You know, these Khalistani independents, you know, just one more thing about them. Very few people, you know, we've heard of Islamic terrorism, and we've heard of, you know, other terrorist groups, but very few people probably have heard of the Sikh terrorist groups. In the 1980s, they were very active. They're still very active. You know, there were, without getting into too much detail here, the most important thing to understand about the Sikh terrorists is that, you know, their base was in Canada and probably still is, and the UK. And in 1985, the biggest terrorist attack in North American history before 9/11 happened just off the Irish coast. And it was an Air India flight 185 or 184, I think. And it 307 people were killed, 86 children blown up off the Irish coast by Sikh terrorists. And the authorities in Canada, the prosecution took a very long time, way too long, and it was botched. I mean, the Canadian Secret Service were accused of having destroyed evidence. Nobody knows why. But eventually, people were prosecuted, terrorists were prosecuted. Talvinder Singh Pamar was most famous leader of the Khalistani independence movement. And it was these Sikh leaders, these Sikh terrorist leaders, who masterminded the terrorist attack. And every year during Sikh Independence Day, or Sikh, they have a kind of Sikh national, you know, festival in Canada and in the UK. These organizations actually join the parade, and they have like the slogans of the terrorists who committed the atrocity in 1985. And Canadian politicians have been seen, you know, dining with these people. You know, this is a huge lobby. And so, you know, this is essentially the nature of the Khalistani independence movement. It's you've got very high level terrorists involved in that. And so this is something that is quite, I think, worrying for India, but also for us, because these are the people now who are partly in government. One of the presidential candidates in Canada, I'm not saying he's a terrorist, but he is from the Sikh community, you know, and he's definitely playing down the terrorist element in the independence movement. And, you know, this is kind of, I'm just trying to kind of describe the kind of chaos we're in now, where we've got ethnic groups in our own countries that are powerful and are even in our government and are involved in destabilization of the home country, you know. And
where do we see that in what you've been describing? There is going to be brand new information to most of my listeners, because they just don't have a clue. It's not because they're stupid. It's not because they're ignorant or lazy. It's just they don't know. It's over the other side of the world, and there's so much going on closer to home. What you've done, and I mean this, it's brilliant the way you've written about this on GerardoColmon.org. I recommend you get onto that, folks. Bookmark the website. Read these articles. Because when you're reading what's happening there in that part of the world, as Garrod has been writing about it, as he said already, it's mirrored. It's being mirrored here in Europe and in the United States and Canada. This is happening. You say some of these people are, some of these minority groups are managing to achieve some success politically.
Yes, I mean, the Sikhs, for example, in Canada are very successful. I mean, they're a very successful ethnic group in Canada. It's in a way, it's a kind of a success story from a Sikh perspective. You had the former governor of British Columbia was Sikh. Now, he was a major critic of the Sikh terrorists, and they attacked him many times. He was hospitalized several times, I believe, for critiquing them. I mean, but the Sikh community are quite successful because, well, I don't know, I couldn't explain why they're so successful, but maybe one of the possible reasons is that they were part of the elite in India. And so they were a fairly elite caste. So, they're well connected. But in Canada, they're so powerful now that Canadian politicians basically have to lobby them to get votes.
That's fascinating to me, Gerard. Can I just interject there? That's fascinating because here I know some Sikhs here in Manchester, and there is a, I suppose, a fairly substantial population of Sikhs here. My very uneducated observation, it must be said, of Sikh men and women is they tend to be very well integrated, I think. And it's not just because a Sikh will have a drink now. That's lazy, Sikh, but yeah.
The Sikh minorities, I would agree, the Sikh minorities seem to be very well, very well integrated in the sense, and also they do very interesting social work. In London, for example, I saw reports about the Gurdwaras. I think that's what they call their temples, where they provide food for homeless homeless people. It's actually the Sikhs now who are increasingly, taking over charity work, and they're providing food for everybody. You don't have to be a Sikh to get free meals. So this has nothing to do with the Sikh community as such. This is to do with people who are in bed with our elites,
right?
Terrorist groups, who are pushing, a really nefarious agenda. I mean, these people terrorized their own people. I mean, they blew up. There were Sikhs in that plane that they blew up, over Ireland as well. And there's obviously, this is one of the contradictions of globalization. But you're finding increasingly that ethnic minorities who climb the social ladder, ally with other, with politicians, and basically it's a kind of, it's a class solidarity. I mean, this is class politics. These people are part of the ruling class in Canada now, and feel that if they can get an independent state from out of India, which is a very wealthy part of India, that will be in their interests, and it would also, I suppose, be in the interest of a lot of Canadian businessmen.
Of course, it will,
etc., etc., and British as well. But there's also another process there that needs to be mentioned, which is the descent into micro states. I've spoken about that and written about that before. You have a process where whereby nation states are breaking up into smaller states. And that's based on, it's a long-term globalist agenda. It's based on the philosophy of small is beautiful of Leopold Kohr, who was an economist from the London School of Economics. And it's based on the idea that, if we just had city states, then we'd have better democracy and so on. But ultimately, you're seeing Catalonia in Spain, possibly Scotland leaving the UK, but all remaining within
the European Union.
And if the European Union breaks up, which I think it temporarily will.
Now explain that. Hang on. I love this because my listeners are subjected, sadly for them, to my opinions on this far too often. You think temporarily the European Union might break up? Explain.
I think that. If Britain leaves, and I hope they do manage to leave, I think that the European Union could temporarily go through a period of chaos where the central institutions would collapse. It's what Soros is predicting. Now if he's predicting it, it may even be part of long-term project.
Right.
But I think that what could happen in Europe is Europe could disintegrate. The central structures could collapse, and then the nation states would start to disintegrate as well. When there'd be no more representative government, there'd be no more budgets. You could have a situation of what's happening in Spain spreading. Now, there is a, you know, a map, the Heineken, the Freddie Heineken map, if your listeners there, they can check it up online. You know, that has, I don't know how many states, but each nation state is split up into several statelets. But I think that if that happened, what would happen is that the European peninsula would be absorbed by the Eurasian Union, you know, and that's, you'd still have global government. I mean, that would be a global government because that would be, that is the world island, essentially, you know, the Eurasian Union. You could put out, you could, Africa's practically joined to it. And there you have it, the world island, essentially. So that, you know, the long-term aim, I think, of globalism probably is that, because the only way to really wrest sovereignty, completely take sovereignty away from European people, is just to divide up their countries, you know. So that's probably going to happen to other countries as well, unless they can prevent it. But, you know, to come back to India, I think that, essentially this, you know, the process of promoting independence there, and it could be promoted by outside powers, is part of that as well. You know,
yeah, I remember I remember 2 years ago, Richard Haass, Council on Foreign Relations, gave a keynote address that is on YouTube for anybody who wants to watch it. And he talked about the idea of the nation state and national sovereignty being dead, that basically countries, benevolent countries, need to accept that and understand that they need to intervene in other nations, whether or not you've been attacked by them. They might be doing something that might be harming the environment, or might be harming people, or might be harming fish or plants or whatever. But if need be, we need to get in there. And I made a big deal of that at the time when I heard it. I broke it up into little segments. So what you're saying is very, very, very interesting. I'm going to tweet out that map, that Freddie Heineken map for
Freddie Heineken for map. Yeah. I mean, the thing about it is that I've made the point before, and, you know, I'm not anti-Putin. You know, I'm neither a Putinophobe nor a Putinophile. I'm skeptical of Russia's long-term role in the world. But I think that the Russians, you know, I got the impression in Spain, you know, that the Russians were kind of in the media war there. I didn't see too much truce coming from Russian media on, you know, on the separatists in Spain. Because I actually think that long term, you know, European states breaking up would actually be in Russia's interest if all those statelets were absorbed by the Eurasian Union, you know. But ultimately, where is that going to go? It's still going to go to towards global government.
Yeah, global governance.
Now, if you look at capitals like Astana in the East, I mean, those, in my opinion, Astana is a kind of it's a global capital in waiting, you know. And the city is completely Freemasonic. I mean, from start to finish. I don't know if you've seen any.
I haven't. I mean, I'll be the first to admit, I know it's in Kazakhstan. That's about the size of it. And that's because I'm a football fan. I know about Kazakhstan, of course, historically, last 20, 30 years, of course I do. But I wouldn't be paying much attention of late as to what's happening there, apart from what you get from the Telegraph, the Guardian, the BBC News. Why Astana? So Astana would be perfectly placed. Tell us about this Freemasonic, I don't know, architecture or symbolism in Astana. That's fascinating to me. Tell me about
it. It is, yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert on it, but I do know that the entire city is based on Freemasonry. And I'm not an expert on all the coordinates, and, you know, you can look it up yourself. But I do know that, you know, Astana is becoming, I mean, it's part of the Russian sponsored peace process in Syria. You know, the Astana talks, Astana is kind of, the city has been built to kind of, to be, you know, a center for Eurasian unity and for Eurasian integration. And again, I'm not criticizing what's going on, because the Russians have had a largely positive role in resolving in finishing the war in Syria. And they've been on the right side of history there. But, you know, again, I'm not impressed by cities that are laid out like that, because, well, what does that represent? I mean, you know, where is that going?
Where is it going, yeah.
And I think that, you know, there is a sense in which I don't see Russia as being necessarily an opponent of, you know, the New World Order. I think Russia's nation state, which has interests, but, you know, China as well, you know. I don't kind of buy into the whole idea that Putin is an anti-Zionist. He's not.
No, he's not. Of course he's not. He's a Zionist.
He's always been a Zionist.
Always.
And he's been open about it, and he's never made any, it's never been a secret.
Hasn't he conducted or held more meetings with Benjamin Netanyahu? Interestingly enough, of course, Israeli elections today. But hasn't Putin had plenty of FaceTime with Netanyahu, maybe more than any other leader in the world of late in the last 12 months or 2 years?
Possibly,
I think so.
Yeah, and again, the two, I mean, Israel and Russia are very close because on a research level, in high technology, nanotechnology, military. I mean, the Russian military buys an awful lot of Israeli arms.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of, you know, I mentioned that in my article, and again, just the one I just finished on India, because a lot of what kind of fools people when they look at these conflicts is they kind of try to pick out the good guys and bad guys. And what happens when there's ethnic conflict with Muslims involved is that the Muslims sort of think, oh, this is Palestine and Israel. So like in, you know, I've heard so many people in the media, you know, the alternative media saying that, that this is like the Palestinians and Israelis. And of course, the Indians are the Israelis and the Kashmiris are the Palestinians. And it's just complete caricature of politics, you know. The Modi regime buys lots of arms from Israel, and therefore it's evil. I mean, well, so does Putin, you know. I mean, it's like I saw this as well in Myanmar, you know, this is part of the kind of the information war that a lot of these Muslim Brotherhood controlled countries do, you know, is to constantly try and say, you know, even when they're the aggressors, that, you know, they're like
the
Palestinians
and
they're like the Gazans and so on, you know. And it fools people. And it's definitely what's happening in Myanmar, you know. There again, it's, you know, I've covered that a lot. And so you've seen that process a lot in Asia. You're going to see that a lot more in Asia, actually. Thailand is another country with a lot of problems, you know. There are lots of countries where that narrative is used.
These are Garoda, come on as our guest. We've got Garoda for another 10 minutes tops. I think we're flying through here. This is important stuff. There isn't anybody else writing about this. You need to go to GarodaColmon.org. I'll put a link out to it in case you, Philistine, you can't spell Garoda Colmon. Outrageous. You should be able to do that at this stage. But we'll get you on. We're talking about uprisings, movements, protests, people understanding what is happening, and then people who don't. We've talked about identity politics, secularism. This is really important. The Yellow Vest protests began last autumn. We're a year into it nearly. And astonishingly, they're very healthy in terms of that the people are still going out on the streets. What do we think now? What do you think now about that movement and what it is, what it's morphed into, whether it's, you know, a force for good, whether it's genuine? I know these are kind of big questions, but you're there and nobody knows more about it than you that I know. I don't know anybody else who's right there and who's seen it and has watched it, who's written about it. What is it?
Well, right now, I can't say I'm optimistic about the movement. You know, it's not going to overthrow Macron, as far as I can see. You know, we're not going to see, you know, a revolution with, you know, people waving flags outside the, you know, the Champs-Élysées, and you know, it's not, it's that aspect of it has kind of withered away. It's the movement is still there. It's still strong because the issues are still there. I mean, and nothing really has been done. And so as Macron basically dismantles the French economy, as you have the deindustrialization, you have the mass immigration, all these things. But politically, the movement doesn't have an actual focus and never did. So you've had far-right groups and far-left groups trying to sort of get control of the movement. And, you know, the so-called far-left, the Trotskyites, Mélenchon has, you know, got you know, hammered in the European elections. He's really a has-been, but because he's a Freemason and he's very well-connected, and he's close to Serge Dassault, who's the chief arms manufacturer in France, he could, you know, they could resurrect him. But, you know, the left never were never really able to own the Gilets Jaunes movement, because the left are not, they don't represent working class issues.
No, of course,
you know?
They don't.
The main focus of the left is defending the cause of finance capitalism through the sexual revolution and mass immigration and global warming. I mean, yeah. They're the three. That's what I call the diabolical trinity of the left. It's global warming, sexual revolution, and immigration.
And vulnerable groups, and protecting vulnerable groups, which is where we came in, protecting vulnerable groups. You and I got into this the very first time we spoke about how the term socialist or socialism has been hijacked over the decades by the media and by social democrats. There is no socialism anymore.
This happened in France in the 1980s with François Mitterrand, because when the socialists got into power, they couldn't deliver. They couldn't, you know, actually implement socialism, or they, you know, I mean, they weren't really socialists anyway. But
no.
So, in order to sort of, I suppose, make people believe that they were that they stood for something, they kind of started pushing this anti-racism agenda. When, of course, anti-racism really was what it was, is saying to the working class, we're not going to improve your wages. We're not going to, you know, give you what you want. In fact, we're going to replace you with cheap workers, and we're going to call you a racist if you've got a problem with that. So that's the entire origin of the anti-racist movement. And that's the cause of the left today, you know, which is why, you know, if I was, George Soros, I would definitely be funding the left, because that's, you know, they're doing a great job in bullying
silencing
people.
And silencing
people. Yeah, they bully them. And we see this in Ireland as well. I mean, I saw a video there recently. I was talking to Brian about it last night. And just the way they're bullying Irish people in rural communities, sending out these government agents who go in, and anybody who objects to the refugee center or whatever, you know, you have these little bullies going around. It's like, that's got to stop.
That's like McCarthyism.
The first people to be ejected should be those people, those government agents, those NGOs.
Yeah.
You know?
These are mad times, Gerard. You know, I see it here as well. I mean, you and I are the first to talk about, we are the first to point out that many people have been displaced from their homes because of the aggression of the French, the British, the Israelis, the Americans, what they've done. We destroy people's homes, their countries.
Yes, of course.
And you and I, and we would never say otherwise, you and I. But people have got to start thinking beyond that and think, well, why do they keep making these mistakes? Maybe they're not mistakes. Maybe these are deliberate policies. And we need to talk about that.
I mean, it's not just the economic destabilization of these countries, the debt economy. All these globalist institutions and what they've done. I mean, that has to stop as well. Obviously, any country that stands up to the UN or to the, you know, globalist institutions gets hammered, like Libya, or has sanctions imposed on it, like Eritrea.
Yeah.
And Eritrea is, you know, again, a very good example of people who don't want to immigrate. They don't want handouts. In fact, they don't even allow NGOs to work in the country. They're very proud. They've got a huge diaspora, hardworking diaspora, who send money back to Eritrea. They're building their country up, and they're getting hammered by the media. They're being called everything under the sun, you know, including all those so-called anti-racist leftists. So, you know, we need to be clear that they are the racists. They are the fascists. You know, so with the mass migration agenda, you know, you have a situation where just people are being shifted around the world, and from in many cases from countries that are actually not, where there are not any wars at all.
You know, that's right.
So we've got a lot of Albanians in Ireland, you know, Georgians, you know.
Competing for jobs with, because I always say this, as a genuine socialist, as I believe myself to be, I've been against Ireland's, you know, ever increasing integration with the European Union ever since I was a teenager, because I could see that, you know, semi-skilled and non-skilled people, and we're not talking about unintelligent people, many of my friends who worked in factories and who didn't go to third level, they're very smart cookies, those lads. Not because they didn't go to college doesn't make them unsmart, but they need those jobs. And what Garrod is describing is absolutely bang on. How could any genuine socialist in the world want to open the country's doors to a low-skilled or no-skilled workforce who will work for less to come in and take jobs that would have been or should have been there for your own semi-skilled or unskilled workforce? I mean, Garrod, it's not rocket science. You can't be a socialist and be in favour.
If you read the classics, you know, the classic documents of Marxism and of the working class movement, I mean, they one of the things they militated against was scabs, you know, coming in who would, and you know, they in southern France in 1947, the CIA brought in scabs to basically crush the workers' strike down there, which was becoming, you know, a major threat to U.S. interests in France and in Europe in general. They brought in scabs to and the mafia, you know, to crush the labor movement down there. And now Marseille today is a nightmare. I mean, it's an absolute nightmare. It's the crime capital of France, and you know, all of the old Marseille, you know, the people are leaving, and so on and so forth, you know. But when the CIA did that in France, when they brought in scabs to destroy the workers' movement, their allies were the petty bourgeois Trotskyist left, that is to say the Socialist Party. And in France from the Second World War to today, the CIA, their preferred partners were the left. You know, that very few people realized that they preferred, you know, Mitterrand and the left to de Gaulle, because de Gaulle was, you know, nationalist and was conservative and traditional, and I suppose too patriotic for the globalists. So, you know, that's the history of the labor movement in the last 30 years. It's just been a complete shambles. So no wonder we're, even for people on the left, I would say, you know, you can't blame working class people for voting for these populists. I mean, who else are they going to vote for?
They have nothing else to vote for.
They're not going to vote for you guys.
No.
You know, it's like, you know, I mean, I that's why I've said I support them, because they're more intelligent than the idiots who are going to vote for, you know, these traitors, you know.
Corbyn, they have at McDonnell,
least,
yeah.
They're at least voting on the basis of class consciousness and their class interest, you know. And, you know, so having said that, I'm not trying to say that the populists necessarily serve working class interests. They don't. But, you know, this is where things are going now. It's basically, it's come down to globalism versus populism.
And chaos, as you described earlier on, and that chaos, I suppose, is going to intensify. We're just about out of time. Garrod's website is garrodocolmon.org. He's on Twitter. He's at Broadford Soviet. I follow Garrod on Twitter. I recommend you do as well, at Broadford Soviet, and it's garrodocolmon.org. Sincere thanks for the history lesson about Kashmir, by the way. Genuinely, people don't hear about
this.
You're
welcome.
And they need to hear it, and they need to put it in context with what's happening in their own backyard, because it's eerily similar, as you eloquently described earlier on. Please don't wait so long to come back, Garrod. Just get in touch. Don't wait to be asked back. These are important issues, mate. And I love hearing from you. I really do. So thanks for that today.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Slán Tomáil. Garrod. Bye for now. The brilliant Garrod O'Colman, live on the Richie Allen Show for Tuesday, September 17th. I really mean it. Go to garrodocolman.org. I've just tweeted a link to where you can find his website. But he's at Broadford Soviet on Twitter as well. That's really, really intellectual stuff. That's terrific writing about Kashmir, India, Pakistan, the Western media treatment of it, and why, you know, and how that segues into what we're seeing happen in our own countries here. It's really, really good, you know, it really is good. Some guy from the Green Party, some putrid piece of, I'm not going to swear, human excrement, blocked me earlier on He made some disparaging comments about the program because I did a piece on vaccines on the show yesterday. It wasn't an anti-vaccine tirade, but it was an anti-Sky News tirade about how Sky News had brought a GlaxoSmithKline doctor onto their program to talk about the need for more vaccines, for people to be more aware of meningitis, which is of no threat whatsoever to anybody, except for the tiny, 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 tiny fraction of people who actually get it. You're 10 times more likely to be seriously injured in a car crash than you are to contract any type of meningitis. And this guy took exception to me talking about it, this Green Party arsehole. And he as far as I understand, because he's blocked me now, took exception to me pointing out that he obviously didn't listen to the show. He just immediately tweeted something hostile to me when I uploaded the little segment from last night's programme. I understand this complete and utter tosser might very well be making allegations about me that are not defamatory but libelous. Please screenshot them and send them to me via an email, because I'm going after these guys. This arsehole's name is Chris Dean McDermott. Chris Dean. So Chris Dean might be a man, might be a woman, I have no idea. But a wretched coward. Blocked me so I can't see the defamatory stuff that's being posted about me. Right? It's no skin off my teeth. I don't melt down when somebody says that I'm a Holocaust denier. I'm obviously not. But when they do, and when they blatantly do, after they've been fucking warned not to do it again, I do get the solicitors involved. Because I like doing that. Because I've got the money to do that. I don't really. The future Mrs. Allen better not hear this. But I like occasionally to bury one of these arseholes. So please, you know, I'd like... But do you know what? I'll get Rog onto it. Forget about it. Rog will do it for me. Rog will do it. And we'll find out then just how courageous, just how brave this Christine McDermott really is. We'll test him or her or it or them or they or whatever the fuck they call themselves. Anyway, that's it for the programme today. A big shout out again to Zach Voorhees. Thanks so much, Zach, for coming on the programme. Former Google and YouTube employee, whistleblower. Very important stuff, that. And I can't say enough about Gerardo Colmón, who's based in Paris, is an Irishman, geopolitical analyst, and writes daily and broadcast at GerardoColmón.org. And if you can't spell that because you're not Irish, I've tweeted a link to the website as well as to his Twitter account, which is at Broadford Soviet. It is at Broadford Soviet on Twitter. I have been Richie Allen. Thanks for listening to Tuesday's programme. I'll be back with you tomorrow, Wednesday, at the usual time of 5 p.m. UK time. I was going to head off to Moor Lane, to the Peninsula Stadium, to watch Salford FC versus Grimsby tonight, but I don't have time to do that because I need to get the programme online. Next time Salford play in the evening, I will start the Richie Allen Show a half hour earlier and finish a half hour earlier, and I'll get myself off to Moor Lane. But they're playing Grimsby, the mighty Grimsby, but I think I'll be able to watch it on the telly, or at least some of it anyway. Of course, that's the future, Mrs. Allen, permitting. Thanks for listening again. Look after yourselves and one another, and have a brilliant rest of your Tuesday evening. Alrighty. Do check out triggerwarning.tv for lots of terrific podcasts and broadcasts by Hayden and Graham. That's triggerwarning.tv. That's youtube.com/triggerwarning, by the way. I'm going out with none other than Manchester's The Hollies. Oh yeah. See you tomorrow.